Hey, leaders, in this episode of Building a Culture of Collaboration, I'm joined by Peter DeWitt and Michael Nelson, two leaders dedicated to supporting other educational leaders through their individual efforts, as well as their latest joint endeavor, establishing the Instructional Leadership Collective. In this episode, we are going to explore the work Peter and Michael do through the Instructional Leadership Collective, how we can build and sustain cultures of collaboration in our organizations, and the impact of human interconnectedness. So let's get started.
Intentional and purposeful focus on building a culture of collaboration is the secret for leaders striving to make a difference. In Building a Culture of Collaboration, Curtis and Lorna Hewson will share simple tips, ideas, and strategies to take your organization's collaborative efforts to the next level.
Welcome to episode 13 of Building a Culture of Collaboration. As always, I'm Curtis Hewson, co-founder and lead learner of Jigsaw Learning. For this episode, I'm flying solo. I normally would have Lorna with me as well to be part, but she's unable to join us. But I am joined by Michael Nelson and Peter DeWitt. Welcome, gentlemen. It's so great to have you on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us, Curtis.
And I did, in our conversation just before, for those watching the video, of course, you're able to see that we actually get to have both gentlemen in the same physical room as one another. For listeners, you can just picture what it would be like. But you said this is one of the first times you've had a chance to do a podcast from the same physical location.
Yeah, I live in Albany, New York, but I happen to be in the Seattle area for work and working with Mike. And so, yeah, I'm at his house outside of Seattle. So this is the first podcast interview we've ever done in the same room. So this is kind of awkward.
I don't know what to do with my hand.
Like on Zoom, so I have to keep looking over at him every once in a while to say, oh, it's really him.
Oh, well, that's awesome. Well, for any of our listeners that do not already know of the work that Peter and Michael do, I'll just give a little bit of a bio, and then I'd love for you to fill in some of the pieces of your leadership journey with our listeners. So as superintendent, Michael was named Washington State's 2019 Superintendent of the Year. During his tenure as superintendent, Michael was elected president of the Washington Association of School Administrators by his peers and is currently assistant executive director for professional learning, Washington Association of School Administrators. Have I got that right there, Michael?
That is all correct. Yes, thank you.
Okay, awesome. And for the gentleman beside you, Peter DeWitt is founder and CEO of the Instructional Leadership Collective and noted author, speaker, and facilitator. Peter's work has been adopted at the state level, university level, and he works with numerous school districts, boards, regional networks, ministries of education around North America, Australia, Europe, Asia, the Middle East, and the UK. Have I got that, Peter?
You do, yes.
Okay, so those are the formal bios. Please, gentlemen, share a little bit of background for our listeners on your journey as instructional leaders. And then I'm really excited to hear about your new initiative that you have going.
Well, I often tell the story that, you know, my leadership journey, I think, started on the day I was born. Both of my parents valued education and just ingrained in my brothers and I at the dinner table that there's no more noble of a profession than that of an educator. And so all three of us became educators. And my journey to leadership was not probably unfamiliar to many, as other people saw things in me that I didn't see in myself. And that little tap on the shoulder or nudge into leadership began to occur. I think if you were to ask my mom or my dad, they would say, you were destined to do that. But like I said, didn't necessarily see it in myself. And so for me, I've had the thing that I would want the audience to know is I have had the great privilege of serving as assistant superintendent and superintendent in the community that raised me. So I have both sets of grandparents settled from Europe into Enumclaw, and I'm actually just a half mile from my Italian grandparents' farm. And so that's where we're sitting right now. And so this feeling of leadership is a calling, and it's one in which we give back to help create that level of legacy to support students and their learning and adults as well.
Oh, I love that, Michael. And I love that opportunity of contributing back to, obviously, a community that you have some deep connections as you share. How about for yourself, Peter?
So I taught for 11 years, but when I was a new teacher, I was probably about 2 or 3 years into teaching. I was doing a master's degree in ed psych, and my principal at the time had been in the district for 50 years. Like 50 years, not 15, but 50. And I remember he came up to me in the hallway and he said, "So listen, I hear you're doing a master's in ed psych. I think you need to change and go into administration," which is what they called it back in the 90s. And I actually looked at him and I said, "No, I'm never going to be a school principal." And I actually said that to him. And I went to the gym later that afternoon, and there were two guys that knew my principal. They were both retired teachers. And I told them what he had said. And they said, "What if you could be the principal you want to be, not the one you think you have to be?" And that was just really powerful. I didn't go back to get my degree in school leadership until a few years after that, when I had moved to Albany, New York, where I live now. But I never actually thought that I could be a school leader, to be perfectly honest with you. I had barely graduated from high school. I was older when by the time I got my bachelor's degree, for most of my life, because I had been retained in elementary school, I'd heard that I was older than all of the other kids around me and all that stuff. And for some reason, I just didn't think I was leadership material. And then I went back to get my degree and ended up getting a job as a principal without any administration experience whatsoever in a school that was just perfect for me. It was perfect for my growth. And I was there for 8 years before I had left to take on this role. So yeah, I like to say that I wasn't born into it, or I didn't have, I didn't necessarily have the parents that were sitting around telling me that I could get into, I should be in the education. There's no more noble of a profession. But I know when I became a teacher, my dad passed when I was young. My mom was very much like incredibly proud of the fact that I was a teacher. And then she was equally as proud when I became a school principal. So I think I was very fortunate that way because I did have friends who did not have the same experience that Mike or I did. They had parents who actually talked them out of being a teacher, or they were disappointed that they became a teacher. And I never had that experience, which is similar to Mike's experience.
Well, I always love asking that question around the journey because lots of times you can be nodding and going, I had some similar experiences and can, yeah, connect with both of your stories in different ways, of course, for myself as well. So I really want to jump in to the work that you're engaging in now. And for those that are listening to the audio podcast, you can't see the beautiful t-shirt that Mike has of Lead Collectively. They're right on screen. This podcast, we really do focus on building a culture of collaboration. And so I'm super excited at the work that you're engaging in now collectively through the Instructional Leadership Collective. Do you mind taking a little bit of time and sharing with us its origins and what that work entails?
Yeah, so it actually, for me, it was inspired by Mike. We met about 3 or 4 years ago, and he had asked me if I would be the lead advisor for the state of Washington for what's called the Instructional Leadership Network. And we would be working with, on a volunteer basis, directors of teaching and learning from across the state. And we started off with about 90 to 100, and then it grew to about 200 or more. And it was just a fantastic experience. It was monthly hybrid approach. And through that experience, I found myself, because this was during COVID, and one of the things that I thought was just amazing is that there were five of us who were working together. And I look forward to those Zooms, which sounds pretty odd that during COVID you're looking forward to a Zoom. And there was just something about this group of people that we were working with. And Mike and I fostered a pretty deep relationship over the next couple of years, and I just was learning a lot from him. I loved his perspective. And so, yeah, about a year ago, I asked Mike if he would consider writing a book with me, and it called Leading with it. It's ultimately called Leading Intent with Intention. It comes out in May of 2024. And one of the things that we were talking about was just creating this platform where we wanted people who felt isolated to learn how to engage with one another. And we didn't care if they were teacher leaders or building leaders or district leaders. We just wanted to create a space where we could lead collectively, where we could work collectively, because that's the work we had been doing. And it's certainly the work Mike was doing as a superintendent. So created the corporation probably in like September, and it officially opened up in October. And Yeah, it's been a pretty amazing experience because Mike's been a fantastic thought partner. And there have been a few things that we've been focused on. We created a platform that's membership driven. It's free to join, but it's called the Instructional Leadership Collective, and it's a platform through what's called the Mighty platform. And people from all over the world are starting to join, and they just have to become members. And then we're doing things like a question of the week. And now we're engaging in the next few weeks, we're actually going to be engaging in smaller communities of practice. And one of the things that we have learned a lot from just the work we do, whether it's coaching or running workshops or whatever, is that a lot of leaders feel isolated. And I'm sure, Curtis, you find this all the time with
All the
Lorna as
time.
well, is that people just
Absolutely.
feel isolated and they want to belong to something where they feel like their voice is valued and they feel like their ideas are valued. And that's what we've been doing with that. We also, you know, we have a monthly hybrid approach with organizations that we're working with, whether it's in the United States, Canada. We're doing a lot of work with Scotland and other parts of the world. And with that, it's, you know, about having this continuation of professional learning that's might be mostly through virtual settings, but then we're in person a few times during the year as well. And what we're trying to do, even with that, is deepen the professional learning that's happening. And this is kind of with Mike's idea, because we, you know, we found over time that people didn't always know why they were in the room. And that was very difficult for us because we couldn't imagine that they were coming to a session and they didn't even know why they were there. And we found that it was happening more and more. People were coming to professional learning. So one of the things that we started doing is making sure that we were sending out a letter ahead of time and sharing our success criteria and then asking them, what's your success criteria? What are your learning needs? And it's kind of been this organic experience because Mike has a very different, he just has a very different perspective than I do, especially when he's been at the district level and I have not. I've been at the building level. And he's been a big fan. It sounds odd that I'm talking about him and he's literally right next to me for the first time during a podcast. So I'm sorry, but he has talked a lot about the dash in between. So maybe you want to go with that part.
Yeah, I would love to hear that, Mike.
Yeah, that sounds great. It's trying to build this foundation of anytime that two people are interacting, there's contributor and listener for understanding, listening for understanding, and that this is constantly evolving in the conversation. And I think sometimes that those core pieces aren't necessarily always there and in place. And building that type of culture that you can, as a leader, you can be both a contributor and a listener and this back and forth flow. But what Peter was talking about in terms of the dash and what we have really focused on is strategies to support leaders between their anchor meetings. So let's just say a building principal, for example, has a series of, during the course of a year, has a series of, 12 staff meetings or 20 staff meetings, however many staff meetings they have in the course of their year. What we often hear is principals going like the day before, what am I going to do at the meeting tomorrow? Or the staff are showing up at the meetings wondering, oh, I wonder what we're going to be doing tomorrow. And what we're trying to present and bring forward is the concept of every anchor meeting is what we call those staff meetings where you're in person or workshops where you're in person. Those are key events that will catapult you to the next key event. But that space in between, so let's say your meeting is, Thursday, and then you have another meeting 2 Thursdays from now. We hope that we can build strategies and practices that when you leave that meeting on that first Thursday, you will be a different practitioner by the time you enter that meeting the next time that you're meeting, because there are next steps and tasks that occur at the end of that meeting, and they generally lead into whatever that the agenda or success criteria is for that follow-up meeting. And so that just is that continuation. And we've seen buildings and districts that have adopted that type of concept that the dash is almost more important than those anchor meetings in terms of moving it into practice with students or into practice within adults working with each other, if that makes sense, Chris.
It makes perfect sense. And it's interesting hearing you talk about that duality of listener and contributor. We often share in our work that when we're really engaging in meaningful collaboration with our colleagues, we're entering into that from the position of expert and learner. And it's the same type of duality that I have something to contribute, but I also have something to take away. And that through that continual process, we're all getting stronger through the support with one another. So that obviously takes a fair degree of intentionality when building not just the anchors that you're talking about, but then what happens in between, which I assume leads into that May release of Leading with Intention. So can you give us a little bit of a preview of what we could expect as leaders hoping to build cultures of collaboration that are intentional? What can we take away from that upcoming text?
Yeah, I find that the book, as we were writing, finishing up the book, and I was talking to Mike, I had said that this is a culmination of our relationship and how it's grown over the years. And, you know, Curtis, you travel and you work with a lot of people, and Mike just always stood out. And there was just always this element of challenging each other's thinking in a very respectful way, but learning so much. I was learning so much. And one of the things that we wanted to be able to do was talk about the fact that so many times we meet with leaders that think they're engaged in actions, but I don't know if they're actually doing what they think they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so we started to really explore the whole idea of self-awareness, leadership self-awareness, and began looking at internal self-awareness versus external self-awareness. The interesting part about that when you're getting into conversations with leaders is they sometimes feel like self-awareness, do we really have to talk about this? But when you start asking them, what do people think about your leadership style? You know, how do you look for feedback? Are you looking for feedback? Or are you doing feedback sharing where you're actually talking about the feedback you've received or criticisms you've received in the past and you want to do better and you're looking for what's referred to as feedback sharing? And those have been really interesting conversations to have, because when you dig down deep into the self-awareness part, people start to really question, do I understand my leadership actions? And the whole idea there is that, and the reason why we're looking at intentionality is that we're always going back and forth with, why are we doing what we're doing? You know, not getting caught up in activity traps and things like that. And really understanding the deep meaning behind, because if you can't articulate what you're doing, then how are you going to communicate that with others? Mm-hmm. And what we know about implementation is that implementation is very, very difficult. And we all come to the table with our own experiences. And just because we might believe that we understand why we're implementing what we're implementing, it doesn't mean the people around the table are. Mm-hmm. And then when you add in an element of things like de-implementation, the abandonment of low-value practices, what we found is that in the research that we've done over the past few years, is that we've surveyed thousands of educators and we've asked them, what would you abandon? And 100% of the time, it's the first time this is like, it was a common theme that just started coming out. 100% of the time, people said they would abandon things that they felt were being done to them, not mm-hmm. things that they were doing themselves. And the interesting thing about that is there's research from 2000 from Vivian Robinson and Helen Timperley out of New Zealand that said the teachers contribute to their own workload more than any initiative does. So then when you start introducing that research into the discussion about internal and external self-awareness, then it becomes a little bit more real for people where they start to question, because if we're always going to say things like we're busy or we don't have time to do those kind of things, mm-hmm. that whole idea of internal and external self-awareness is really, really important, because all of that, not having an understanding of that, impacts negatively the initiatives that you might be trying to focus on. And it also should make you question, why are we focusing on these initiatives in the first place? So that is chapter one, believe it or not. So, you know, and then we lead into something that is just always been Mike's strength. I mean, I've met people who have known him for decades, and I've been fortunate enough to stay at his house and, you know, and just spend a lot of time with his wife and family and go to the school where he used to lead. So I know this to be true. is that one of the things that is so important for him is this idea of human interconnectedness.
And we are definite. Actually, let's jump there right now. That was one of the questions that I had, but you've given me the perfect segue. So I had an opportunity to listen to the podcast that was titled How to Deepen Collaboration with Your Teams. It was one, Peter, that you did on your Leaders Coaching Leaders, where Michael was a guest. And that was one of the things I took away, was that when you were focusing on deepening collaboration, Michael, you had shared something that you refer to as human interconnectedness. So can you share with us what that means, and how do leaders go about really putting direct, again, that word intentionality comes up for us, direct intentionality on the importance and building of human interconnectedness?
Well, thanks. And I have to pay a huge tribute back to Peter and my wife for this one, because, you know, I'm year 39 and my wife, Britt, would keep saying, you know, you need to articulate not necessarily what you do, but how you do it, because there's a key in that. And I really didn't understand necessarily that. And so I was, when Peter asked, said, hey, do you want to co-author a book together? I said yes without even thinking, Curtis. And so I remember calling my wife and saying, I just said yes to co-authoring a book. It just came out. We didn't even talk about that. So it's like, oh, that's okay. But this might be a chance for me to really reflect. And, you know, the other thing, Curtis, you know, when you talk about life experiences, and Peter just mentioned that as well, I have a son who's in his second year of being a building principal at a middle school here in Washington State. And wow. He said, Dad, and he grew up as a child of an administrator, and he and our daughter would oftentimes, we would have retreats here at our home, and the kids would be with me, and they would stand side by side as I was facilitating staff meetings. And Hans said, geez, Dad, I just remember you had them working together and they were connecting, and now I'm leading my own building. Tell me more about that. And so, boy, the last year, Curtis, I've had a lot of time to think about it. So here's what my best description. And, you know, there are so many books and so many phrases about relationships. And I hear that, and it's not that it's a negative, because it's a huge positive building relationships, but I don't know that it fully describes the essence of building that key culture within a building or within a school district, like I did as a superintendent. And so, because I oftentimes hear, you know, well, I wrote everybody, I have this checklist, and I wrote everybody a handwritten card, or I brought donuts here, and therefore we should have relationships. And it's well beyond that. It's like every action, every behavior, every utterance out of your mouth is a part of contributing to relationships. And sometimes that doesn't get mentioned. So we coined the term human interconnectedness. And the thing that I know is I feel, and Peter feels the same, and that's why we've connected so well, is we feel like we're still teachers. And we are constantly thinking with that teacher mindset, and how can we best improve ourselves? How do we best create this learning environment in whatever situation we're in, whether it's a workshop or this podcast, for example? How can we create learning and understanding, or make people think? And so our best description about human interconnectedness actually comes from the story of the giant redwood trees. So the giant redwood tree, if you look and you Google them, there's not pictures of them standing alone. Giant redwood trees are always in clusters. They have a very shallow root system, but their root systems are intertwined with each other. And as they grow in height and stature, their interconnection grows stronger and stronger. So they're able to survive during turbulent times, during terrible storms, and they still stand straight and tall. And the trees that have that taproot system and stand alone, they more likely topple over with the wind. And people say, you know, things in education change with the wind, and you hear those phrases like that. But there's core essence that we can build within school and district cultures that don't change with the wind, that we know our truths about the work that we're doing. That's that interconnectedness. And so I hope for your listeners, that image of the strong, you know, redwood tree and the root systems and the interconnectedness and growing with each and every year and day helps provide that image of what we mean when we articulate human interconnectedness.
I had never heard that the story of the Redwoods, or but the image that that's given me. I'm reflecting back, and Peter, you had mentioned the, you know, we implemented this during COVID, and we've been fascinated that during that really unpredictable, turbulent time, the schools that we saw that were able to endure through that in the best possible way were the ones that actually had strong collaborative cultures that people felt connected, intertwined. And we often remark that those that leaned into their structures and processes during that time did way better than the ones that said, okay, we'll stop getting together to meet, even if it's on online. We'll everyone just go back to yourselves and we'll worry on just the operational sides of things. Those were the places where we saw high stress and people feeling like they were all by themselves and overwhelming. Yeah, it's you're right, because that wasn't just winds, that was a hurricane. I love that image.
You know, Mike and I, we talk a lot. And one of the things that is kind of a common theme for us, besides feeling grateful for being in education, which I know to some people might sound corny, but it's really not. For me, it saved my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. It really did, because I didn't know what my options were back then. And I look back now and just always feel so grateful to be where I am. But we're also the experiences we've had, and maybe it's who we are. Maybe it's the fact that we look for it. Maybe it's the fact that we want to bring in collaboration. But whether we were both teachers, school leaders, or with Mike being at the district level as a leader, we always wanted to collaborate with other people. Like I never felt like I was supposed to go it alone. And I think that was the hardest part about getting into consulting, which, you know, Curtis, I'm sure you've experienced, even though you and Lorna do this together. You know, for years, I thought, oh, I'm going to be a part of this, you know, consultant team or something like that. And that's not the way it worked. You're on the road by yourself and you're doing a lot of work by yourself. And over the past few years, working with Mike, I just, you know, I told him, and I tell him quite often, I don't want to go back to working alone. Like, I don't want to go back to writing a book alone, because yeah. I feel like what I'm doing is to a deeper level. I feel like the conversations are a deeper level. I feel grateful to a deeper level. It's because when you find good people to collaborate with, it changes your life for the better. But I think that we also have always been open to that, in whether we were teaching or leading, because we didn't want to go it alone. So I hope that makes sense when I say it that way. I think, you know, we were talking earlier today, and we were talking about the whole idea of collective efficacy, you know, and having the shared commitment and engaging in joint work. And one of the things we talked about is that this whole idea of collaboration, though, is not just about how a leader sets up collaboration among staff. It's also about staff inviting your leader in.
Yeah.
You know, we work, and I'm sure Curtis, you work in the same schools sometimes, that, you know, there are actually contracts where principals can't go into classrooms, or they have to be announced first. I went into classrooms every day as a school principal, and my teachers didn't have a problem with that, because they knew it was about me understanding that going into classrooms was a way to make their observations better, because I was better informed about how they were teaching and what they were teaching and the kids they were teaching. And what I think is important about this whole idea of collaboration is not just it's the leader's job to set it up. It's also the teacher's job to also invite their leaders in and make their leaders feel comfortable, because there are leaders I work with where some teachers don't make them feel comfortable when they're coming in. So collaboration is not this one-sided thing that one person sets up for everybody else. It's really got to be the mindset of everybody that's there.
Well, and that really speaks to the whole emphasis or genesis of this podcast. Is you're talking about a culture.
Yeah. Right?
It's a culture of collaboration that we set up. So Michael, I am interested in your role from a superintendent's level, because I've had several superintendents that have said, you know, I can put forth vision, I can do a lot, but really the principal role is where we're going to really see the impact that'll happen for learners. But how do you go about supporting your principals in establishing exactly what Peter talked about, that culture of collaboration where it's not one-sided, it's not directive, it's we work as a team. How do you go about that from your perspective?
I think that's a fantastic question. I'm going to probably attack it maybe a little bit different than you might think. I think there are some foundational behaviors and actions that the role of the superintendent can have a huge impact on learning. I don't disagree with the research that the principal has, you know, and the percentage that the principal has in improving instruction. I get that research, but so I was superintendent of a district of 42 to 4,500 students during the tenure in which 13 and a half years I was superintendent. Here's some things that I think made a difference. My office wasn't on the third floor in the back corner. Yeah. My office was in the front corner, first floor. People, as they came in the front door, they could turn right and right into my office if they wanted to. My car was always parked in the furthest parking spot. And people know in a small town where you are, it wasn't this reserved spot. I was in schools all the time and knew staff's name by name, knew families, knew the connections. I think when you establish as a superintendent those key core values and you put yourself out there as a learner yourself, I wrote a message every Sunday night in the form of a letter and usually a story tied to learning that nudged all 600 employees, asked them a question. It was my Sunday evening news. When I first started it, we didn't have wireless, so I would go upstairs, you know, all the sounds that would come on and connect and write the letter to staff and push it out. And, you know, to this day, people remember those letters. They, you know, it's little things of getting to know you as a human being. When it was a snowy day, staff knew I was the one of the individuals getting up at 3:30 with my dog, Duncan. I would take pictures. We would go to Starbucks. There's that human side of being the leader. None of what I just told you directly ties to students meeting standards, the third grade standards in reading, but I think has a huge impact toward that end. So when I come in and have conversations, and Peter describes a story of, you know, during observations and when I'm having conversations, I'm quoting Peter now, with teachers, I'm in their classroom and we're having the conversation in their classroom. As a superintendent, it was the same with me. So I'm in your building. We're having your conversation with you. Teachers know that teacher, you know, and so when I'm walking the building with the principal, there's that connection. And I believe because of that foundation, it's a whole different level of personalization and not this hidden person. So when you're not that hidden person, you can have an impact on the learning because of the culture that you created.
Well, you know, Michael, I'm reflecting on that. And again, you just came back again to talking about being a learner yourself. And Peter, it was in your book. I've got it right here, Collective. But I don't know if you remember, you talk exactly what Michael is professing here, that idea of developing a leader and a learner mindset. And again, this kind of goes back to that listener and contributor, the duality of those roles that I think is so important.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's probably why, I mean, it's funny because we have so many thoughts that are aligned, obviously, but he sometimes just has this different perspective that comes in. And I'm like, huh, I never thought about it that way. There are just so many conversations that we have like that. But at the heart, you're right. You know, coming in as a learner is really important. Whether I'm coaching, running a workshop, whatever, I want people to know. I was in Chicago yesterday running a workshop and then flew here last night. And when I was with them yesterday, because the person who introduced me as an expert, which is not a word I'm comfortable with.
That one, the guru one.
I always
get that little bit of a cringe when I.
Yeah, I want to, like, I just like to crawl under the table during those moments. And one of the things that I said to them was, you have to understand that you have an expertise because you understand your context better than I ever will. Mm-hmm. You know what your buildings are like. You know your kids, your whatever, it's, you have an understanding of your context that I don't have. When I'm working with superintendents and when I'm talking with Mike, Mike has district level experience. I don't. I've worked with a lot of superintendents. I can certainly hear what they're saying, but I was never in that role. Mm-hmm. So the learner part is really important too, because I need to go in and understand, what am I going to learn during this situation? Because if we're not learning in the situations that we're in, then why are we doing it? So whether it's a coaching session, whether it's a workshop, we're trying to build in ways where we're giving them time to process information, but also get an understanding of, what am I learning about this at the same time? Sometimes it's really like, it's so important to the work we're doing. I'll give you an example. I train school leadership teams from across the state of Arkansas, and I work with Arkansas State University, and it's a combination with a couple of different organizations. So these leadership teams are coming in from across the state. And the third time we were together out of six times, I just asked a pretty simple question. So when you're doing this work, how often do you meet? Do you meet every 2 weeks? Do you meet every month? And they said, well, counting the times we've been with you, we've met three times. And I'm like, that's a really important question that I should have asked, right? And I said, okay, you have 30 minutes right now where you're going to start planning out a calendar of when you're going to meet as an instructional leadership team. And I heard people talking. They said, well, we can't do the morning. So I asked, is it because of contract that you can't meet in the morning, teachers? And maybe it's a teacher contract thing. And they said, oh no, we drive the bus. And I asked, what do you mean you drive the bus? And they said, we have a full bus run in the morning for about an hour and a half. And then we teach all day. And then we have a bus run in the afternoon. And the principal, I looked, and there were like two teachers. And I said, oh my gosh, like, I can't, you choose to do that? And I'm not kidding you. Two thirds of the room said, Peter, we all drive the bus. Mm-hmm. Principals, teachers. And I said, no wonder why you can't meet in the morning or the afternoon. They have full bus runs with 50 or 60 kids. And they looked at me like I was odd, because one looked at me and said, well, Peter, who drove the bus when you were a principal? And I said, the bus drivers. And those are the things, Curtis, that, you know, exactly what Mike was talking about. Is it about the third grade standard? No, it's not. But it is about respect. It's about the fact that you're working with these teachers and leaders who are not only teaching and leading during the day, but they have full bus runs in the morning and in the afternoon. And they want to meet as an instructional leadership team and engage in their deepest priorities so they can have a positive impact on their schools. If I wasn't a learner, I wouldn't have learned some of that information. And I would have been missing a huge part of the context, which meant the implementation of the work I was trying to do with them would have suffered, because I wouldn't have understood what those pieces, those challenges that they face. And after knowing that, not only was it about getting past those challenges and figuring out when to meet and still be impactful, on my side of things, it was a lot of, like, I'm walking away saying, these people are working hard and they're giving so much of their time.
Yeah.
And they're trying to do so many different things to have an impact. How many people in their community, or how many people across the United States or North America or whatever, actually understand that teaching and leading might be a whole lot more complicated than they think it is? Yeah. They're not coming in and working 9 to 3. You know, there's so much of that. So being a learner and asking questions means that I'm opened to hearing those things, and then starting to figure out, how do we problem solve about this together? So there's no downside to going in as a learner.
Absolutely. Well, I was actually involved in another podcast earlier this morning as a guest, and I had talked about, as a young leader, I fell into the Superman syndrome myself of, if somebody comes and gives me a problem, great, I'll fix it. That's what I'll try and do. And I'll take your stress and put it onto myself. I had a superintendent come in and say, this, your office is like a goose nest in the fact that people come in, squawk, dump stuff here, and then they leave. And it was a bit of an eye opener for me with that. So Michael, I'd love to hear your insights from a system leader perspective. How do you respond when you see that? Because I'd like to assume I wasn't the only young leader who thought, I've got this title now, that means I do everything for every one, rather than what I should have been doing of asking questions, understanding things deeply, and how can I support you in attending to that? How do you go about that? Because really it's about creating collaborative cultures rather than thinking you've got to take it all on as yourself as the superhero principal.
I think that's a syndrome that probably every leader has experienced at some point in their career. And I certainly have. And I listen to, oftentimes our son will either call my wife or myself on his way home. It's just a ritual. Yeah. It's a way to download because he has a young family, so he doesn't interfere. You know, leadership is hard. You know, Curtis, I think of it as more of an and. I think there are moments, so I'm guarded with my answer to say, no, you should always not give the answer, and you should always, you know,
context is important, right?
Let them come up with the answer. And so we did lots of role playing with our leaders around situations. And so you have somebody who's come into your office, this is what the situation is, how are you going to respond? And we would do fishbowl activities, and we felt that grew us as a team of leaders in that type of role play fishbowl situations. And there are times when, yeah, it's simply easier to say, yeah, this, you know, if it's tied to a direct policy, a direct something that we need to do, I can give you that answer. I can be Google for you and support you. I might say, here's maybe where you could find that next. And then there are times when it becomes, and we call that more consulting type of conversation. And then you move into a coaching where I'm only going to be asking you questions, you know, and then there's times when it's collaboration of, okay, let's take the piece of paper and let's figure this out together. And that's collaboration. So we kind of filtered things through those lens, and then we would role play in this situation. Are you a consultant, collaborator, or are you a coach? And play with that type of concept. And that seemed to break that cycle of the, what you call the goose nest. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are getting close to finishing up this episode, but there's always a question that we love to ask all of our guests. And I'm going to pose it to you first, Michael, and then I'm going to slightly tweak it as I pose it towards. So this question is, what advice would you give a aspiring or veteran leader who's trying to create a culture of collaboration? I'll turn that one to you first, Michael, and then I'm going to tweak it ever so slightly when I direct it towards Peter.
Okay, so a culture of collaboration. I'm trying to pause. If I'm thinking through the lens of the leader, this is what keeps going into my head is speak less, listen more, and listen to understand context in the situation.
Absolutely. I love that. And it's something I've had a chance, well, not just through this podcast, but of course, lots of interactions with leaders where you hear that more and more of the advice I would give my former self of listen more and really listen for what's being asked. So I want to flip this to Peter, but I'm going to do it in a slightly different way. So, and I'm going to just share a real quick story. I had a chance.
Nervous right now. I can tell, Curtis.
You can feel nervous. The tightening up. Yeah.
You said you were going to tweak it. He thought he was going to have some reflection time, and now he is nervous. So give it to him.
We don't want to give any of that extra prep time to one individual over.
Well, I was like, I could answer that question now.
Okay, so in 2015, I've been working with schools, and all these ideas were flowing, and so had self-published a book with my wife Lorna around our collaborative response work. We then, of course, have engaged and learned so much since that time, reworked it almost completely for what came out not too long ago from Corwin. And I actually cringe a little bit when I see people holding the old one, because I go, the thinking since that time for myself has really shifted and changed. And I'm almost a little bit cringy of some of the things said in that one, because they're not things I think I would say now. So with that, you literally wrote the book on collaborative leadership back in 2017. What changes or what things might be cringeworthy in that, where you go, my thinking slightly changed since that time, now 7 years later? And what advice would you give now to someone trying to really focus on collaborative leadership?
So a couple of things. Number one, I don't think it should ever be cringeworthy for you. I don't. I think in 2015, you were a different Curtis.
Yeah,
I think that if anything, your thinking evolved. You know, the hard part when you're writing a book is that it's not until after the book comes out that you're working with audiences on that content, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, of course you're playing with the content when you're writing the book and stuff, but after the book comes out and you're working on the content, your thinking is still evolving. So and I'm not saying this to have a safe answer. I'm still very proud of collaborative leadership. Like I look back on the Six Influences, I wouldn't change a thing. That was the first book where somebody took John's work and actually talked about some practical steps to do. And John and I still talk about that, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was a really important piece. I would say where my thinking evolved is that in the book, I talked about instructional leadership. I would talk about instructional leadership as an influence to a much deeper level now than I did back in 2014, 15, when the book came out. When I talked about collective teacher efficacy, I talked about it a few more times, but my thinking evolved to collective leader efficacy, which is that other book that you held up. So I wouldn't say that there was anything cringeworthy. I would say that I think what's important for people to understand is that our thinking has evolved because of exactly what we were talking about earlier, which is we go into these situations as learners that when we're delivering the content, when we're talking about the content, we end up deepening our thinking because of the people that we're working with. I would say the one thing that was cringeworthy, because I don't want to skirt that answer, is that the thing to me that's cringeworthy is how I deliver the content. Back then, I probably talked, no, back then I talked way too much. So when I delivered the content, it was a lot of drill and kill. And I would give people, you know, 2.5 minutes to process information. And they're like, okay, let's move on. You know, over the past few years that I've worked with Mike, and it's one of the many reasons why I love working with him, is that he has forced me to say, can we slow down? You know, he was talking earlier about listening more and talking less. It really is something that he embodies. And for me, nowadays, when we're running workshops, we're probably delivering content for about 40% of the time and giving about 60% of the time for processing. So that would be the piece that I would say that I have changed the most. I went from just talking about collaboration and the research around it. And I truly was collaborative as a leader. I was collaborative as a teacher. I know that. But I think that I've deepened my level of collaboration because of the fact that I value so much giving people time to process information and hearing from them and just slowing things down. Just yesterday, with what I was, you know, with the workshop I was running in Chicago with the school district, we were working on their strategic plan and the actions they're taking from the strategic plan. I looked at a third of my content that they had already looked at and said, you know, this is perfect. This is what we want. But in the conversation of one of the areas where they were processing, I knew that's the space we need to spend more time today. That's important because they're not going to have time to go back to their school district and do this work. Right now is the time they're going to do it. So I got rid of a third of my content just so I could do that. Those are things that I probably never would have done, you know, 8 or 9 years ago when I was starting in this role, but it's definitely something that I will always do from now on. So I hope that helps answer
that
question.
It does. And you know, I'm reflecting on that, Peter, too, of that idea of even as a leader in a building, how do I create space for people to create their own understanding? And really that is collaboration, that if I as a leader am constantly directing and saying, this is how we'll collaborate and this is what we'll do next. And, you know, I've created the agenda for us to collaborate. We probably haven't created the space to bring out everybody. And
I'll give you one more example. So when I was a principal, I used to flip my faculty meetings, and everybody was, you know, still to this day, they're like, wow, that's so innovative. But I would do that differently now, because back when I was flipping faculty meetings, you know, the first thing we focused on as a staff was feedback. And, you know, I sent out an article ahead of time. They had to bring examples of their feedback. We talked about the evidence. It was a non-judgmental activity. It was mm-hmm. to deepen the learning. But the next faculty meeting, I moved on to something new that I was going to flip.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I would do that totally different. I would say, you know, this is where it was teacher driven. You know, we're focusing on feedback and bring in your evidence and all that stuff. then I would say, so these are the strategies we talked about. The next month before our next faculty meeting, I want you to try that strategy a couple of times and then come back with evidence about how did it work? Why didn't it work? Let's talk about it and keep that steady thread going. The dash that Mike talks about, as much as people thought it was innovative that I was flipping faculty meetings. And at that time, it probably was because it wasn't just an agenda-driven kind of thing we were learning together. I would look and say, I need to slow that down. So for my advice for leaders, whether you're at the district level or the building level, is that do you talk at your staff or do you actually give time to process information and engage in these deeper discussions where we're going to learn from one another? Because with the strategies we're trying to do these days when we're running professional learning, it is so great to hear people talk about their perspective on what it is that we're focusing on, as opposed to just always being about my perspective, because I, you know, maybe we wrote the book on it. So I would say the slowing down piece is something that is so vitally important, and giving people time to process information, because, you know, compliance doesn't mean they're understanding what it is that you're talking about. And only when we're engaging in conversations can we understand how to deepen that learning.
Excellent. Well, I really, really have valued this conversation and value your time as well, being able to join. And I'm glad that we've been able to create an opportunity for you to be together in the same room as well. So as we finish off, can you just share how our listeners, best way to get in touch with you if they'd like to be able to learn more and to know some more about your leadership collective?
Yeah, so you know what? Why don't I give you some breaking news at the same time we're doing this? So
yeah, awesome.
You can go to our website. It's the Instructional Leadership Collective, and we have all the information you need there. You can actually go there to get the link to actually join our platform that is behind the member wall, you know, and it's free for everybody. And you can find tons of resources and videos and all that stuff. But the breaking news is that you can also find us, because Mike is going to be my new co-host for the CoreWinds Leaders Coaching Leaders podcast.
Oh, awesome.
And that really is breaking news, because it honestly just happened about 3 hours ago. So
okay, by the time this comes out March 9th, it'll be old news, but I'm honored that I got it right away.
Yeah. So Tanya Gans, our editor, has asked Mike to actually be my co-host for the Leaders Coaching Leaders podcast. So that's going to be, and we're going to finish out the season together and then, you know, talk about a whole new season next time around.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I've been honored to have you join. And I think the lessons that you're sharing and key understandings are going to be really valuable for our listeners. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for taking the time. And I wish you all the best in your efforts moving forward.
Thank you so much, Curtis.
Thank you, Curtis.
So once again, I have the awesome opportunity to be able to stop and reflect what was shared there from Michael and Peter. Usually I'd have Lorna to be able to banter back and forth with this, but I'll do my best to really summarize. You know, there were many things in this episode that stand out to me, but that image of the redwood, I could see that and gave a perfect illustration for what we see over and over again in schools that are deeply committed to ensuring robust structures and processes related to the collaborative response, to infuse that culture of collaboration. And the idea of the strength and the beauty of the redwoods, but I did not understand that the root system wasn't that deep, but how intertwined it became. And I think that's just a tremendous message, that when we can create those connections, and I love Michael's idea of human interconnectedness, wow, that creates that culture in our organization that we can endure whatever it is that comes, whatever the needs of the student or the communities that comes forth, that we can attend to those because of our interconnection. I often reflect, and I mentioned it in our conversation, that idea of duality of role of expert and learner when we're engaging in collaboration. But both Peter and Michael reinforce that again with the idea of you can be a learner and a leader. In fact, it's critical that you're adopting that mindset. But then when you're engaging in those conversations, how can I be a listener and a contributor and recognize the importance of both of those. And I think the balance is so important because we heard a clear message of listen more, speak less. And that has certainly been one of my understandings over time. I still have to work on it myself personally, but so critical for us when we're building a culture of collaboration for our organizations. I also really love the message that came around slowing down, giving time to process and creating that space that if we really want deep cultures of learning to be established and sustained, we need to create space where we can come back over and over to deepen our understanding, to be learning together within our organization. And I think giving attention to understanding that there will be, as Michael referred to them, anchors or anchor meetings that we have, and we want to be intentional and thoughtful of that. But sometimes it's the in-between that is really where we're trying to adopt and understand and go more deep in the work. He referred to it as the dash. And I love that thinking for us that through that, we're valuing perspectives and the individual understanding that comes from that. So in the show notes, of course, we'll be linking the Instructional Leadership Collective. There will also, I had mentioned a podcast that both Michael and Peter had engaged in. I'll link that in and anything else that they send to share along to engage in this great work that they're doing. I'm also including in the show notes a new guide that we've published around 5 planning considerations for leaders that can transform your team meetings that may be valuable for you. It includes also a free meeting template that can be adjusted and adapted to help actualize some of those considerations. As always, would love for you to check out our book, Collaborative Response, and there will be a code in the show notes to be able to get a discount on that. And if you found value in this episode, we'd encourage you, please share it with one friend, with one colleague that can take away from the wisdom that Michael and Peter shared with us today. So until next time, thank you so much. And in the words of my wife, see you soon.